Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. A Supreme Court judge says drug and alcohol-related crimes in Samoa have been gradually decreasing since the introduction of Samoan's Alcohol and Drug Court. In 2015, 61% of cases were alcohol-related, and the figure dropped to 55% a year later. Justice Mata Kelly Tugatagalo says the pilot program will run for 3 years, and there are plans to extend it next year. He told Catherine Ryan about the philosophy behind the Alcohol and Drug Court.
It's about harm reduction. If we reduce the use of alcohol that's related to offending, then society is safe.
And when it looks at trying to divert people from what is causing them problems, what are the kinds of mechanisms it's using? For example, I imagine family and support groups, are they prominent in the system?
Yes, we draw in the family. You know, the whole thing about Samoan life is about family, culture and religion, and those three things are being drawn in. Also because the alcohol and drugs is a social problem, so we need to engage the community. So by engaging the community, before we accept anybody into the alcohol drugs court, we hold a family group conference, and that will enable the treatment team or the team to also vet the environment, find out that the environment is not high risk for the participant to live in. We also engage what we call community justice supervisors, who are usually churchmen, village mayors, or family matais, or village woman representative. And those will help monitor this alcohol drugs court participant while living in the community and participating in its programs.
It's an extraordinary level of cooperation between the court and community, isn't it? And it's quite formal in some ways. Yes. They almost become another branch of the system, don't they? As you say, the ministers or the mayor or the family or women's groups almost become part of the rehabilitation.
Yes, we have to draw them in. Look, that's the whole title of my presentation, Takes a Village to Raise a Child. This child was brought up in the village. They helped nurture the child. Any problems or offending by this child, it's because what's living in the village or in the family communities out in the villages.
What are the aspects of Wha'a Samoa, of culture essentially, which are drawn on to help combat the drug and alcohol problems? The involvement of all these people is one thing, but practically, what are some of the aspects of Wha'a Samoa that are engaged to give effect to that?
Well, we seek the assistance of the Ali'i and Faipuli out in the villages, or the village matais. They are aware of the participant and the court conditions imposed on this participant living out in the village. They will help support this participant and making sure that this participant will not be seen around anywhere alcohol is consumed. He is also being drawn into I suppose what you call the untitled men's activities, where the village matais would keep an eye on those untitled men. So all those will help keep this person away from using alcohol and or drugs whilst in the programs. Well, drugs is a big no-no out in the villages anyway.
The government of Papua New Guinea's national capital is planning a nationwide scheme to get idle youth off the streets. Powell's Parkop says the scheme would give them work training or have their involvement in community activities. He told Don Wiseman the idle youth pose a liability for the city and for the country.
There are many non-school leavers out there who are just staying idle, haven't got much going, and we can't leave them out there idle, no mentoring, nothing positive going for them. It's going to be a greater liability. And we have seen all the evidence of this for the last 42 years, leaving our young people out on the street, staying idle. They just wander off into alcohol and drug abuse and, you know, other bad things.
How many of the grade 10, grade 12 school leavers leave and get into work?
Not a lot. I know in Port Moresby we have a lot of young men and women just staying idle. And we know this from our program, which is reaching out to these young people called Urban Youth Employment Program. We are overwhelmed. we don't have enough space for them. And we have opened it up to the rest of the country, even though it's a city program.
What would they do?
Well, some do military service, some can do community service, some can do, you know, do volunteer service. But we need to have a program in which they can participate in that program, build good self-esteem, acquire skills, develop positive character before we take them to another level, like maybe to tertiary education. If they cannot go to tertiary education because their grades are low or there is no space, then we put them into this program so that it prepares them maybe for TVET, technical and vocational training, or some other program that they might pursue. But the alternative is worse.
As you say, the government's been dragging its feet over this issue.
Yes.
But the country is also in a real economic pickle at the moment, isn't it? Who's going to pay for it?
Well, we just have to find the money. I think we can pay for it if we come up with the costing and we look at how we can structure it so that, you know, we don't have to have a big program one go. We do a pilot project, we see how it goes, and then we can build it up gradually. Right now, you know, I want to get as many young people as possible off the street.
How many do you think might be brought into it? Because you'd be talking tens of thousands, wouldn't you?
Yeah, in Port Moresby alone, we have around 5,000 young men and women coming out of our secondary school and high schools. So maybe 10% of that will go to the tertiary institution. Everybody else just have to fend for themselves. So we try to integrate them into the technical and vocational scholarship that we have and also to the Urban Youth Employment Program. So the balance of it, maybe 2,000 or so, will go into that program that I'm proposing, the national service. Or otherwise, if it's not a national program, it becomes a provincial service. So they get basic training, they have some discipline and so on. But in terms of their deployment, some can serve in the military or police, or some goes to serve as volunteers doing community work, looking after the elderly, working with people with disability, doing community service in other words. So I tried to look at some model like in Germany, they have the type of model. And I'm trying to visit Singapore to have a look at their model. But, you know, Don, we've got to make decisions here in Papua New Guinea. We're just not making decisions, and that's part of our problem here in Papua New Guinea. We know the problem, but we are not making decisions. And if we do not make decisions, then the problem just escalate and become worse. So it might not be a perfect, absolutely ideal solution to the challenges that we face, but I can't sit back and just say, okay, maybe naturally it will solve itself. It won't have a natural solution.
On the U.S. island of Hawaii, there's been a lot of discussion going on whether or not to allow people to walk the streets with concealed guns. Well, the state of Hawaii actually opposes this. Derek Chen spoke to Sarah Viatura on the safety issue concerning this.
Over the decades, our lawmakers have gone to great pains to make sure that firearms are regulated very strictly in our island state. And just as an example, some of the ways that people in Hawaii are restricted from carrying guns is if someone has previously been convicted of a domestic abuse crime or a violent misdemeanor, then those are people that are not allowed to conceal or carry a weapon. Now, that's in contrast to other states in the United States that have more lenient laws.
So this particular bill that is being proposed, how did it come about?
It certainly seems like this bill came about from, you know, the firearms lobby, and it's essentially requiring reciprocity, meaning that Hawaii as a state would need to respect the gun regulations that are in other states, even if they're more lenient than what Hawaii currently has. So, for example, if somebody was coming into the state of Hawaii, then we would be required to honor whatever firearms regulations that their home state has. And we find that to just be, you know, completely a terrible step in the, definitely a step in the wrong direction, because states have their own sovereign right to be able to determine their public safety, we're in the best position to be able to determine what's best for our community.
Do you think it might encourage things like gun trafficking?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the concern is that this type of activity would actually encourage people or facilitate gun trafficking, because it would allow traffickers to even more easily transport guns across state lines with just a driver's license from one of the states that do not require a permit. And so this is a big concern for us. And I've got to say, this is the timing of this bill being proposed by Congress couldn't be any worse. I mean, we are all still recovering as a nation from the Las Vegas shooting and certainly even some of the other states that joined in this opposition include states such as Connecticut, which had to deal with the Sandy Hook tragedy involving public school students who were gunned down, as well as the state of Virginia, which went through a shooting at one of its universities, Virginia Tech.
Have there been any mass shootings in Hawaii?
The one that resonates the most for people still to this day occurred about 20 years ago. There was a shooting at a Xerox company where it was a coworker who got very upset and basically had killed about 8 or 9 people. That number might be small, but for an island community such as Hawaii, people really remember how shocking that was to have that kind of shooting take place.
Seems to go against the concept of aloha.
Oh, absolutely. And I think one of the things that Hawaii enjoys because of the different regulations that it has is we currently have the lowest crime rate, in our state since 1975, since we first started taking records on the crime rate. So to us, we attribute that to the great work of our law enforcement partners here, as well as the work of the different policymakers to really make sure that we are regulating the use of firearms.
So you're not the only person speaking out against it. Who else is opposed?
Oh, not at all. In fact, this opposition includes state attorneys general from 17 states, which represent over 140 million Americans. So that would include the states of New York, Massachusetts, California, Virginia, as well as the other states that I mentioned, such as Connecticut. So collectively, this is a very large group of people that do not want us to have to reciprocally allow the states that have more lenient practices to impose their regulations on ours.
So what is the next step for this bill in particular?
Well, it's going to be up for a vote, and that time, we want to make sure that people are aware of this, and certainly Americans are being able to voice their concerns to the various policymakers that are going to vote on this, so that this bill goes by the wayside and is not something that passes forward. We don't agree that this is the type of law that should be passed, particularly in the violent times that we live in right now.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Next year's independence referendum in New Caledonia will be subject of talks in Paris this Thursday and Friday, chaired by the French Prime Minister Edouard Philippe. The Nouméa Accord, signed in 1998, has provided a 20-year decolonization roadmap that will expire next year when, according to the accord, a vote has to be held. But issues remain which need to be discussed by the signatories of the accord. Walter Zeifel has followed the story for some time, and Jamie Tahanaha asked him about the significance of the meeting.
This is the most important meeting in years, mainly because the clock is running, as every year the pro- and anti-independence politicians are in Paris for a formal meeting of the so-called signatories to the Nouméa Accord. The talks are chaired by the Prime Minister and follow a history of French Prime Ministers overseeing crucial New Caledonia talks.
So what are the pressing issues that are left?
Well, a key aspiration is to organise a referendum that has maximum buy-in so that the outcome will be accepted by all sides. An independence referendum in 1987 was boycotted by the pro-independence side, and as a result, the loyalists won with more than 98% favouring the status quo with France. Now, a major stumbling block is the very basic question of who is allowed to vote. Since 1998, this has not been conclusively resolved.
So what is the problem?
Well, French law requires for any voter to be registered on a general roll. The Nomi Accord restricts voting in the referendum to long-term residents, but it also says that all Indigenous Kanaks are allowed to take part. Now, the problem is that the Kanaks demand to be automatically enrolled for the referendum, as stated in the Accord, without first going on to the general roll.
And just how big an obstacle is that?
Well, the suggestion is that more than 22,000, or about a quarter of all possible Kanak voters, are at risk of being left out. The low number of registrations is in part due to the territory's history, as for the first century of French colonisation, Kanaks had no voting rights. So many, for a raft of reasons, still don't bother to take part in the electoral process. And here the issue of legitimacy comes in, as there are fears that after the vote, the outcome can be viewed as unfair and therefore be rejected. And after the 1987 flop, nobody wants a repeat.
So what can the upcoming Paris meeting achieve in this regard?
Well, it could find a way out of this apparent deadlock. A new court opinion suggests that a law change could be pushed through, which would allow all people born in New Caledonia to be automatically on the general roll. This way, all Kanaks would be registered for the referendum vote as well. However, non-Kanaks would have to prove their attachment to New Caledonia.
And what is the referendum question?
Well, that has not been determined either. There is now talk of yet another signatories meeting next year to finalise that very point. But in the meantime, huge challenges remain. There is no agreement on what the possibly independent New Caledonia could look like. There are many questions, ideas for a possible post-referendum New Caledonia that have been floated, include creating a state associated with France or even a federation between New Caledonia and France.
Now imagine this, you've just been elected to Parliament for the first time. Your political party stood on anti-corruption platforms, motivated by removing the sitting government and energized legions of young voters. The party emerged from the election greatly strengthened, but it fell short of forming a new government. Then the majority of MPs in your party decided to follow their leader and join your political enemies in government without you. Well, that's the story of Brian Kramer, an MP for Magdan in Papua New Guinea. Mr. Kramer says he decided not to join the government defection because his aim of removing Peter O'Neill-led government was his main priority. He told Johnny Blaze the splits caused by the defection in both of the party's parliamentary wing and its executive office remain high and unresolved.
I mean, that's the policy that we, the party, collectively campaigned on. So for some of us, maintaining that integrity and moral principle was more important to us than the convenience of being in government and having greater access to IBSIP funds. The party leader, Sam Babb, has come out publicly and said that the reason he went across there because he couldn't access IBSIPs is evidence of the fact that it has actually been used as a political tool.
He's talking about it as being a pragmatic move. He's been in opposition a long time. Maybe he simply is seeing that he could get more done for his constituents and for those of party members if they're in the government, for better or worse. Do you think there's some merit to that?
Well, if you look at the election results, and most of those that were in government in the last government, they held key ministry positions. They all got voted out. So obviously that theory has no water. So most go to government not for service delivery, they go there for convenience. If you campaign on a policy or principle to fight corruption and fight the O'Neill government, then that's what you're supposed to stick to. If people got elected on a different policy, and that is to just go in, become a member of parliament and do your part and feel elected, that's fine. So, I mean, every member took a position when they campaigned on their policies, and those are upholding some of their policies and others are backflipping and changing and flip-flopping on their policy.
The Pangu Party had such a great success at the polls, really, you know, given where it came from, as you said, that it had been a party in obscurity for a few years as well. How do you feel personally about how that happened and your relationship with Sam Basil and the others?
Oh, look, I mean, at the time, obviously, I was disappointed. I made my position known that your leadership will always be tested. At the end of the day, we're going to be judged on it. So, I mean, everyone at the end of the day comes to a position time where they have to make a decision, then eventually held accountable for that decision. Sometimes you've got to test the integrity and trust of and loyalty of individual people, and circumstances in life will provide that testing ground. So they've now taken the position to go to the other side. I think there's still a lot to get done. I believe the party is bigger than any individual person in terms of the country. I think we need a party that people can have trust and hope in, and that's, I think that's missing at the moment. And Sam's decision to move is, that's where it's created, you know, a lot of undercurrent of distrust now in the general public about who do they trust.
Vanuatu passports are in question again after a plan was announced to allow the use of bitcoins in exchange for citizenship. Early this month, the Vanuatu government backtracked on the announcement just days earlier that would accept the cryptocurrency. The media director of the Vanuatu Post, Dan McGarry, has been investigating the story, and he spoke to Sala Jane Hopgood.
Bitcoin, it's an electronic technology that actually doesn't relate only to online currencies, but also has to do with anything that requires an audit trail. So you can do it for any number of different things. But the most common and the best known use of what's called blockchain technology is Bitcoin. It's a virtual currency, which means that you can use it more or less as you would use money, except that it only exists on your computer. In other words, you can't hold a Bitcoin in your hand. The news that came out recently, which has since been rebutted in a number of different important ways, is that one agent who was selling Vanuatu passports announced that they would be accepting payment in Bitcoin, and that became, the story as it was first told became one where people were being told that you could buy your Vanuatu citizenship in Bitcoin. Important parts of that story turned out to be false, however.
Do you know why Vanuatu was a target for this scheme?
Well, this is something that we're still looking into, actually. I've been discussing with other more reputable members of the what's called the wealth mobility aspect of things. Wealth mobility basically is when people want to move their wealth out of the country that they're living in currently. Sometimes involves buying passports, obtaining citizenship by legitimate means, I have to say. This happens most often because people are a little uncertain about their future. The bottom line is that Vanuatu does not have a good reputation worldwide. They are not considered to be properly run, to be well administered, and there are a number of aspects to the programs that we have in place that are not shared by other more well-established passport sales offerings. And therefore, that puts our reputability into question. And it makes some of the more credible and the more reputable agents shy away from us. And I've been speaking with a few who told me in as many words that, you know, the way things are set up in Vanuatu right now, we just don't want to touch it. And that's quite worrying because it means that the people who do come to us are perhaps not quite the kind of people that we would want.
So the systems in place in Vanuatu are being taken advantage of?
There is some concern that we might have people playing fast and loose with it, trying to sell passports to people who really don't deserve them, not necessarily doing the due diligence that should be done. These are all matters of extreme concern because the last thing that anybody wants is for Vanuatu to have a reputation as a place where the dodgy people go.
Why does the government reportedly want to distance themselves from the scheme?
Well, the government has actually driven a great deal of this, and the problem is that it hasn't shown a great deal of consistency over the years. We've got four separate programs that have been set up, each one after the other, as people get new ideas about how to tap into this money. And I have to say, the money is quite significant. It's a couple of percent, at least, of our annual GDP. I mean, you know, it's quite a large amount of money, in excess of, we're seeing projections for 2018, in excess of $40 million. That's a significant part of our annual revenue. In fact, it's the single largest source of revenue aside from the VAT.
Pacific Island nations are predicting the most competitive Rugby League World Cup yet. Samoa, Fiji, Tonga, and Papua New Guinea have been boasted by the addition of some world-class talent. And as Vinnie Wiley reports, they are now pressing the sports governing body to address the pay gap between the haves and the have-nots.
Samoa are the highest-ranked Pacific nation at fifth in the world, and they're strengthened by the addition of Queensland and former Australia back rower Josh Papali. The tour face a daunting World Cup opener against New Zealand on Saturday. But coach Matt Parrish believes the Pacific nations are the strongest they've ever been.
World Cup's come around every 4 years. It's unfortunate that you got to wait that long to play a top-level nations. But, you know, this is our opportunity to show what we've got. It's, you know, obviously the other bit young Pacific nations too, it's their opportunity to show what they've got. And, you know, I've got no doubt that this World Cup is certainly going to toss up a few surprises.
Fiji have reached the semi-finals at the past two World Cups and can call on the attacking threats of Jared Hayne and the NRL's top try-scorer, Suliasi Vunivalu. Butty coach Mick Potter says the squad have big aspirations but can't look any further than Saturday's opening clash against the United States.
If you slip up in your first game and you go in with any complacency or anything like that, you find yourself out of the World Cup. I don't like the old cliches, but we certainly have to be mindful that we need to win our games and we need to win our first game. So I'm not jumping the gun, I'm not setting any targets, but I know we're very ambitious, but I think it would be foolish for me to come up with anything publicly, and although our aspirations are high.
Mate Ma'atonga have grabbed the headlines since Jason Tomalolo and Andrew Fifita opted to switch allegiance from New Zealand and Australia and were quickly joined by Manu Ma'u, Sio Sua Takiaho and David Fusitua. Despite coming in for criticism, coach Christian Wolf is adamant it's good news for the game.
Well, I think that's exactly what you want for a World Cup, and you want it to be competitive, and you want the best players playing it, and that's what the change of rules. Yeah, they are the right change, even though they've copped a bit of flack lately. They're certainly the right change, and they're heading in the right direction, and they've allowed all the best players to be available for different nations. So that's what it needs to be about.
Papua New Guinea will create history on Saturday when the country hosts its first ever World Cup match between the Kumuls and Wales. The National Football Stadium in Port Moresby is a sellout, and coach Michael Marram says there's a huge buzz around town.
It's finally coming this weekend, so everyone's looking forward to the match against Wales this Saturday afternoon. You know, a lot of people turning up at training and that sort of thing. You know, there's a lot more requests for the players to go out to schools and hospitals and that sort of thing. But, you know, we're really mindful of the time we got left. And our main focus is just on training, preparing the side to go out there and play well on Saturday.
Despite making big strides on the field, Pacific nations say the playing ground remains far from even off it. Christian Wolf says players make a big financial sacrifice to represent their heritage over the likes of Australia and New Zealand. Matt Parrish says it's grossly unfair and the governing body needs to take the lead in addressing the financial disparity in the international game.
You know, they've got a board there. They need to have some spine and make sure that every team in the tournament gets the same amount of money. Then we'll see. Then we'll see a much evener contest. You know, at the moment when you got three teams getting $20,000 a game and you got the rest of us getting pittance, you know, it's very unfair and very uneven. But if you pay everyone the same amount of money, then the players choose who they want to play for. I can tell you, then it'll be a lot different story.
The Rugby League International Federation pays expenses for all teams during the World Cup, but it's up to national federations to provide match payments. International Development Manager Taz Bateri says Australia, New Zealand and England can afford to do that, but Pacific nations don't have the same capacity.
So the International Federation is the one that will be required to see how we can prop them up, and that'll either have to come through excess revenue from the World Cup to be able to have enough surplus income to pay the players what they would be due. So it ain't going to be solved overnight. And let's hope that this World Cup this year will deliver the outcome that we need so that the International Federation is in a much stronger position to be able to afford to pay the players what they deserve.
Taz Bateri says the matter is likely to be on the agenda when the board of the International Federation meets in Sydney next week. This is Vinnie Wiley.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of the program. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.